This is the Meiji at 150 podcast. I'm Tristan Gruno. On this episode, I'm talking with Dr. Lisa Yoshikawa, Associate Professor of History in the Department of History at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Dr. Yoshikawa is the author of Making History Matter, Kuroi Takatsumi and the Construction of Imperial Japan, published by Harvard University Asia Center in 2017. Dr. Yoshikawa, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me.
In your book, Making History Matter, you take historians during the Meiji period to task a little bit in how they justify Japanese imperialism. So could you explain how is it that the professional historians during that time are contributing to Japanese imperialism?
Well, first of all, it's a process in which the historians are justifying Japanese imperialism, most likely because they support Japanese imperialism, but also with another motivation, which is to get the field going. And in order to do that, so this is at, we're talking about the academic history. The importance of academic history is introduced very early after Meiji Restoration, but actually establishing the field, that doesn't get going until probably mid-Meiji into 1890s and turn of the century. So they're trying to establish their own field based on the German model. And for that, what they need, of course, the university system is already being started to be established. But they, in order to establish the German sort of Rankian-influenced historical field, they need to establish archives, and there's all these practical matters, train students. And in order to get support for that, that's one of the reasons why I argue that the historians try to get support from the state sponsors to try to establish their field. And one of the ways they're doing this is to legitimate Japanese imperialism. And, you know, they do it in various ways. One of the things that they are tasked to do is initially to write a history of Japan, essentially a national history, what they eventually end up calling Kokushi, a national history of Japan, because it's part of to try to establish the state of Japan. So one way in which they do that, the initial effort really by the academic historians is started by the first generation of historians, which are people like Shigeno Yasutsugu and Kume Kunitake. And they attempt to write national history. So national history meaning, you know, starting from the beginning, a linear narrative, right? From the beginning of Japanese history to back then it was to the Meiji period. So trying to write that history, but, you know, in the 1890s, this is the first Kokushigan that was just published in 1890. This is before Japan gets its first colony, if we exclude what's today Okinawa and what's today Hokkaido. It's really the second generation of historians who are writing after Japan gets Taiwan and Japan starts going into Korea, first as a protectorate, that they really start narrating the empire into Japanese history. And one of the ways that they do this is to write a malleable history in terms of, so they have to obviously deal with the chronology, a linear chronology of Japanese history, but they also have to deal with defining Japan geographically. And one way in which the Japanese historians, the academic historians, tried to legitimize Japanese imperialism is to try to keep this geographical border quite malleable so that, you know, as the new territories are being incorporated, that can in the future be written into the linear history of Japan.
You mentioned historians such as Kume Kunitake. In the book, you also focus on Kuroi Takatsumi. So who is Kuroita and how does he fit into this story?
Right. So Kume and Shigeno and then Hoshino is the sort of the three early historians. Those are what I call the first generation of historians. So they're the ones that are better known. Japanese historians in Japan have been writing about them. People like Okubo has been writing about them. Those are usually known as sort of the founders of Japanese academic history. And those were the people who initially attempted to write this history of Japan as a scholarship. But all three of them pretty much get fired because they go overboard is the dominant narrative that's been around for a while, in that they take the evidentiary history too far and start questioning some of the imperial myths that have been endorsed by the supporters of this new nation building. So what my book focuses on is Kuroita Katsumi, who's the second generation. So Kuroita and people like Tsuji Zennosuke and also Mikami Sanji, sort of 1.5th generation. But those are the second generation of historians who are trained by the first generation of historians. But they come to age around the time the Japanese are acquiring these Taiwan and then later Korea. So these are the historians who start writing Japanese history to incorporate those places into the narrative of Japanese history. So these second generation historians play a much more significant part in terms of legitimizing Japanese imperialism in Meiji.
Speaking of this historical legitimization, it's funny that you mentioned the mythological narratives, because I kept thinking about the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki as kind of a retrospective legitimization of the Yamato court.
Right.
Is there a kind of similar function going on here with the kind of writing in legitimacy over these newly acquired territories?
Well, for example, you know, sort of the one of the most well-known ways in which historians in general, or actually anybody using a historical narrative to justify Japanese imperialism, was, for example, you know, colonizing of Korea and how they referred to the myth of Jingu, who was one of the mythical female emperors who supposedly went and conquered Korea and established Japanese colony in Korea. So, you know, trying to use those older texts like Nihon Shoki and Kojiki to set up a precedent for colonization of Korea. The importance of academic historians is that they stress the fact, most academic historians trained at Tokyo University stress the fact that they are academic historians. They work with scholarship, right? So they try not to make that simple connection of precedent, for example. What they're trying to do is that this is scholarship that is backed up by evidence, by documents. And therefore, as this is a scholarship with a certain methodology conducted by people who are trained in a certain way. And a lot of this, again, goes back to borrowing from the German system. They use the fact that this is scholarship. So Wissenschaft is the term that they were using back then. Scholarship, therefore, this makes our story, makes imperialism legitimate, because this is scholarship and not just a popular piece of history. So in terms of using Jingu, for example, people like Kuroita talk about the invasion of Korea by Jingu, but in a much more delicate, balanced manner. You know, the point is that Kuroita tries to establish a early connection between Japan and Korea to justify Japanese colonization of Korea. But at the same time, that early contact can't be so early so that it takes away from Japanese exceptionalism that allows Japan to colonize Korea. So those older texts are used in a much more delicate way to justify Japanese imperialism.
Speaking of not going too far back, well, we don't want to talk about the alliance between Pekche and Wa, for example.
So that was the time period that Kuroita was referring to. Jingu was 4th century, if I recall. But, you know, it's a much more complicated argument than saying Japan was colonizing Korea in very early in the history. Therefore, that legitimizes Japanese colonialism of Korea in the 1905-1910.
I was reading the annual reports put out by the Government General of Korea. They talk about the archaeological excavations that they undertake. And I've always considered, you know, is this a way to find that historical evidence? You know, maybe if we can actually find archaeological proof for Jingu.
Right.
Does this, is this another way of looking?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Yeah, that's the whole other area of this, is that sort of to try to deal with, what do we do with these myths? Because obviously there's no evidence to back up a lot of these myths. And the Japanese historians like Kuroita back then were aware of this. But so that's why scholars like him turned to archaeology. He is also one of the early people to try to introduce archaeology into Japan. And one of the reasons he pushes archaeology is because he feels that so this is coming from the fact that from 1908 for about 2 years, so Kuroita travels around Europe, and one of the places, he goes to many places, one of the places he goes to is to the digs that are happening around the Mediterranean. And he hears about the story and he witnesses the excavation in Troy and how, until Troy was excavated. So his understanding is that until Troy was excavated, a lot of the Greek myths were just myths. But once the archaeology proved the existence of Troy, then those myths no longer were myths. They became history. So that is also going on. Kuroita is one of the earlier ones who go to the peninsula with other scholars, of course, to try to find evidence of early Japanese occupation of Korea, of course, which they don't find. Also related to this, the fact that not just in terms of Japanese imperialism, but also early Japanese history too, that, archaeology is going to help the scholars, as long as there's no evidence to disprove the existence of the early emperors, for example, right? We have to keep on digging because maybe there might be evidence that we find to try to establish, the Japanese history further back into time.
You mentioned that one of the reasons that these professional historians are so actively encouraging imperialism, perhaps, is as a way to solidify their own positions within a changing academia. So what is happening to the profession of history and the discipline of history during the Meiji period?
So the initial attempts, so in 1869, right after the Meiji Restoration, the initial leaders put out a memo saying that history is important and history is fundamental to establishing a new state. So they start working on trying to establish a history of Japan. And, that leads to establishment of the history department once the Tokyo University is established, et cetera, and the first generation of historians trying to narrate Japan and try to legitimize Japan and later imperialism through history. But there's a lot of problems. Margaret Mayo was one of the scholars who wrote in English about this. But there are a lot of problems as the historians try to do this from 1880s into 1890s. And what ends up happening is basically that those first generation of historians fail. And they, they set up a historiographical institute to try to collect documents to write these histories. But the historiographical institute gets closed in 1893, right? So what do we do here? The history profession of history is already in its decline. And, there are other means rising in terms of trying to legitimize the Japanese state and Japanese imperialism. And so what the second generation of Japanese historians have to do is try to resurrect or resuscitate the field of Japanese history. This is, again, in mid-1890s into the turn of the century, 1900s. So that's part of the story there, is that, the Japanese historians initially tried, but the government didn't approve. So what do we do now? One of the most important institutes for historical study is closed. Where do we go from here? And so one idea is that let's support the Japanese state formation, Japanese imperialism through history, so that the discipline itself can get support, both in terms of, well, most importantly, monetarily, right? But in terms of political support.
And in doing so, as you mentioned, they almost come to supporting status authoritarianism and aggressive expansionism, which is counter certainly to this interwar liberalism. So you get this kind of counterintuitive situation where the academics and intellectuals are somewhat actually supporting what we might think of as fascism.
They are. Well, if you call that fascism, if you're talking about sort of the interwar illiberalism, so these forces fighting against the liberalism, people like Kurohita are standing on the side of supporting illiberalism, right? So especially after World War One, with the rise of national self-determination and related to imperialism too, and within Japan, rise of sort of more movement towards relative democracy that starts in Japan, there are forces, authoritarian, anti-liberal, illiberal forces in important parts of the government, among the philanthropists, for example. And what the Japanese historians like Kurohita end up doing is to take that stance of illiberalism to fight against the rhetoric and movement of interwar liberalism and sort of internationalism in general. And they do that they change their rhetoric so that their rhetoric might be in sync with the language of the liberals, for example. But in reality, what they are advocating is sort of this Meiji authoritarianism. You know, this is going into Taisho, but advocating sort of Meiji authoritarianism and, you know, holding on very pretty strict, heavy-handed colonial policies.
I noticed you're talking about military expansion abroad, political repression at home, but very carefully not using the word fascism. So I'm curious, you know, would you say that, can we define the mid-20s and 30s as a time of fascism in Japan, or should we be more cautious in using that term?
You know, I think once we, well, let's put it this way. Fascism as an idea, I think, was the idea, a lot of the ideals of fascisms were not taken up by the governmental authority in the 1930s, sort of the philosophy behind fascism. Miles Fletcher was one of those people who wrote about how the ideas, fascistic ideas, were not really being accepted by the government. But at the same time, as I was looking into some of these commemorations that historians and others were orchestrating in the 1930s, you know, surrounding historic figures, or, you know, if we go up to 1940, that the 26th centennial of the empire, with all this sort of popular support, right? There are fascistic elements that I see, especially once we get into the 1930s, of these populist support of these totalitarian state. I'm still going towards being convinced that this period can be defined as fascistic. Although I think some ideas had actually, the fascist ideologies have been rejected by the government.
And since you mentioned commemorations and certainly the kind of politicization of history and professional historians, can I ask you to talk about perhaps, you know, not only the commemoration of the 2600th founding of the empire in 1940, and then of course there's the centennial of the Meiji Restoration in 1968, which is another kind of movement, and now this being the sesquicentennial, right, of the Meiji Restoration. So what is the kind of politics of historical commemoration?
Well, it goes back, right? You know, politicization of sort of commemoration of historical events, we can trace back, you know, in Tokugawa period. But really sort of the modern politicization of these historical events, historical people. You know, we have, for example, you know, the celebration of Ninomiya Sontoku, for example, something like that, sort of celebration of historic figures really go back into Meiji. But I think things change in the 1930s. The scale becomes much larger. And, you know, in the 1930s, a lot of these are spearheaded by academic historians, again, to give historical legitimacy, because these are being headed by academic historians who are trained to do this. So that celebration of historical figures and events, you know, there's also the celebration of the Kemmu Restoration, for example, that's happening in the 1930s, and a bunch of celebrations surrounding Kemmu Restoration. But in the 1930s and 40s, we see academic historians really taking part in these movements. And the 1940 celebration, the 26th centennial of the Japanese Empire. Too. By that time, Kuroita is gone. He's still alive, but he's sick, so he's not really part of it. But some of his students are participating in such an event. The most well-known name is Hiraizumi Kiyoshi, who's oftentimes pinpointed as the historian that collaborated with the authoritarian government and the wartime government. But certainly the role of historians in these celebrations go quite far back, but the nature of it, I think, changes in the 1920s and 30s, and definitely by the 40s. What's interesting in the 1968 centennial of the Meiji Restoration is that, you know, a lot of progressive historians were, of course, on the opposing side of this commemoration that was being led more, to my understanding, by some parts of the Liberal Democratic Party, of course. And the Japanese progressive historians are fighting this. But at the same time, what's interesting is, you know, historians also learn that, you know, these are moments in which, because these are historical celebration, the field of history can gain, right, from these celebrations. So for the 1968 celebration, it's one of the things that happened is there's a push to establish the Dareki Haku, which is the history museum that's in Chiba. This was a project that was started by Kuroita much earlier, but was never finished. So, you know, these moments are also being used. So same way in which the historians were trying to establish their field, right? They politicize, they support certain political events, political leaning using historical arguments. By participating in this commemoration, the historians are also trying to add something to their field, trying to make their field, keep their field, or make their field important and significant. So 1968 was the progressives seemed to have lost that battle, and the celebration for the centennial seemed to have gone on to a certain degree. But that commemoration, for example, some of the historians from Todai are trying to have a history museum established. So again, I think these commemorations are being used for academics for the purpose of enhancing the discipline of history too.
As you mentioned, in 1968, you have all these very prominent progressive historians, and it kind of reminds me of, you know, you always hear about in the post-war period, a lot of the historians are, or the most prominent ones, you know, are kind of Marxist in their interpretations, right? So Tanaka Akira or Inoue Kiyoshi, these historians that are very critical of the Japanese wartime regime. Maruyama Masao, of course, right. Another would be another example.
Right.
I mean, with that in mind, are these historians, do they feel culpable for some of what happens in the wartime, or are they self-reflective about the role of professional history in legitimating imperialism?
You mean the historians of 1950s, 60s?
Right, the historians who survived the war.
Well, the problem there is that, you know, these are students, especially in the 50s, these are still direct students of these historians like Kuroita and others who are supporting the war effort, right? Or, you know, interwar liberalism that led to the war. So for the most part, they have a scapegoat, which tends to be people like Hiraizumi Kiyoshi that I mentioned before, or Itazawa Takeo is another one. Okubo Toshiaki is the one who becomes sort of this father of Japanese historiography. He also was a student of Kuroita's at a certain point. And what happens is that they try to downplay the amount of politicization of history that was going on, especially by the main founders of the field. And by doing that, they themselves also are not implicated in, you know, what's also happening here is that, you know, by the time 1930s, when the second generation historians are established, these students are also helping, write these people like Kuroita to write general histories of Japan or in whatever projects that these interwar and wartime historians were working on. So as students, they're helping them. So they are also, you know, to a degree, linked to this illiberalism as a project and support of this illiberal government, authoritarian government, and Japanese colonial efforts. And in a way, they try to write that out of their recollection of Japanese history.
I teach a Pacific War film class. And so one of the early post-war films that I show is Kurosawa Akira's film Wagaseishun ni Kui Nashi, No Regrets for Our Youth,
which is
kind of a dramatization of the Tokugawa affair, where this professor gets kicked out of Kyodai in 1933, I think it was. And so you have this whole kind of narrative of the red professors in the 1930s, ones who are speaking out against militarism.
Right.
But notably, they aren't historians.
They're not historians, right? Because most of the historians in, especially in Tokyo University, were not speaking out against the war. They were supporting the war effort. So Takigawa was in economics, was it?
Yeah, I think I just remember he was teaching about Tolstoy, maybe a law professor or something. Minobe Tatsukichi, of course, was a law professor, another one of these so-called red professors. But it's interesting that the historians are the ones who are openly supporting the war. And then, you know, maybe this is why in the post-war period, there is such a reaction or almost rejection of this pre-war history.
Right. So when the post-war historians started writing about how they or their predecessors were doing history, right? One of the narratives, historiographies about their predecessors is that the entire enterprise up to a historical enterprise up to 1945, academic history, was a failure. That the first three historians were back to Shigeno and Kume and Hoshino tried but did not succeed. They got banished from their positions because they were too overzealous in trying to write history using evidentiary history and questioning the myths. So the authorities shut them down. And since then, historians have just been collecting documents, and it was going to be the post-war historians who are going to use those documents to try to pick up where they left off pretty much in the 1890s. And then along the way, you know, there's martyrs like Tsuda Sōkichi, whose work gets censored by the late interwar and wartime government, for example. So that tended to be the narrative of these scholars. And that came out, you know, when the Marxist history was at its heyday.
So what is the legacy of all of this for the history profession today in Japan?
Really, the issue of historiography is just getting to be revisited by historians today. Of course, those Marxist historians of the 50s and 60s and then going a little bit into the 70s wrote their own history using those primary sources, but also in a very theoretical manner. And then those histories that came out of those decades, a lot of them are quite useful, but because of the nature of the studies, they focus on certain economic factors, for example, and overly focus on economic factors, for example. And because they're so theoretical, and of course also supportive of, again, politicized support of what's today regimes that are today considered to be problematic. There's Stalinism, PRC, North Korea, etc., that historians tend not to want to look back at the scholarship that came out of 1950s and 60s to, although their contribution in terms of revitalizing the historical field, sort of the general contribution, might be commended today. But it seems like today what's happening is the attitude is going back to primary sources, right? You know, what's often said today is, for example, rather than publish elaborately theoretical, analytical monograph on a certain topic, which goes out of fashion within a decade, to really leave a mark as a historian, it's most important to publish a collection of documents, for example. So that, I think, is one of the legacies that remain because of the history of historiography.
And so maybe a turn to a less partisan or maybe even turn to a more empirical research, perhaps.
Right. Turn to more empirical research in a way. But we also have to remember that that's what earlier historians of pre-war Japan were also claiming to do, was empirical research. Not to say that, I mean, I don't really see a particularly partisan agenda coming out of Japanese historians today, but in the rhetoric seems similar in terms of focusing on primary documents.
The Meiji at 150 podcast is hosted by Tristan Gruno at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. This podcast would not be possible without the cooperation of the UBC Center for Japanese Research and the technical assistance of the UBC Faculty of Arts ISIT. Find out more about the Meiji at 150 project, including the Meiji at 150 lecture series, digital teaching resource, and workshop series by visiting our website, meijiat150.arts.ubc.ca. Thank you for listening.